You are listening to a podcast from Raritan Valley Community College.
I want to be able to say a couple of words about our keynote speaker today. But by far, I had an opportunity to speak with her and an opportunity to visit her website and read a little bit more about her. And she truly is what I consider a global citizen. And I know that the information that she will share with us will be very enlightening, especially in recent times in North Africa. It's always important to be able to expand your knowledge. So we are so thankful that she is here with us. But without further ado, I'll move forward with her formal introduction. She is a Fulbright scholar. Anissa Mehdi is an Emmy Award-winning journalist, filmmaker, producer, specializing in religion and the arts. She is president of Wheatstone Production, a boutique production consulting firm in New Jersey, and as artistic director of the documentary Voices, Pulling Focus, an initiative launched in Dubai in July of 2008. She was a 2009-2010 Fulbright Scholar in Jordan, where she mentored professional broadcasters and taught aspiring filmmakers. Anissa's commitment to peace in the Middle East is a lifelong passion. She grew up in an interfaith Muslim-Christian home. She remains an active voice for Arab American politics. She reported news from and made documentary films in Algeria, Egypt, France, Iran, Jordan, Malaysia, Saudi Arabia, and South Africa, Turkey, and the U.S. Her National Geographic special, Inside Mecca, is a recognized classic. Her PBS Frontline film, Muslim, shows the cultural, economic, and social and political diversity of Muslims around the world. For ABC Nightline, she produced a series of Muslim programs on their faith and on non-Muslim cultures and on stereotyping in popular media. She is a winner of two Emmy Awards, the CINE Golden Eagle, and numerous prizes for the Society of Professional Journalists. But by far, our speaker is what I consider to be a person for all seasons, a Renaissance woman. She is she holds a master's degree from Columbia University, her BA, cum laude, and Spanish and literature from Wesley College. She lives in New Jersey with her husband and two daughters. She is a trustee of the Shakespearean Theater of New Jersey and sits on the board of directors of Music for All Season. She plays the flute and the piccolo in the Livingston Orchestra. And again, we are so honored to have her here with us today. I would like to introduce our moderator, who is also serves as the Women and Gender Studies Committee Chairperson, Anita Rosenblatt, who will then introduce our panelists. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Is this working? Can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay. That was a beautiful introduction and incredibly well deserved. I also am very honored to have Anissa Mehdi with us today, and I just want to introduce our panelists. I'm in the English department, and as Richelieu said, I'm the chair of the Women and Gender Studies Committee, and I'm really delighted to have these wonderful panelists. They're also part of the Women and Gender Studies program. And first of all, I want to introduce Brandon Heppard in philosophy, and okay, and Andrea Vaccaro in ESL, and Jacqueline Scholl, or Jackie Scholl, in communication. So we have a wide variety of respondents here. And I just want to say, I want to set up the ground rules a little bit. Anissa Mehdi is going to speak And then afterwards, we're going to have respondents. Each of us, or each of the three respondents, are going to talk. I'm going to limit that a little bit because our main objective is to open it up to all of you. And so after they have given one question each, we're going to open it up to the group. So put on your thinking caps. I'm sure it's not going to be a problem. And feel free, after they have asked their questions, to go ahead and ask yours. But we're definitely going to leave lots of time for interaction with our speaker. And without further ado, we're going to turn it over to Anissa Mahaney.
Thank you. Thank you, Doctora Rissaline. In Jordan, I would be Doctora Anissa. So thank you, Doctora Rissaline, for that beautiful introduction. And I'm looking forward to our conversation as well. Implicit in any conversation about social transformation and gender is the question of power. Who has it and who has access to it? So in this matter, I turn to the authority of my daughter. She's now 17, but when she was 3 years old, she said to me, "Mommy, who's in charge, you or Daddy?" Well, I didn't quite know how to answer that, so in my journalistic way, I said, "Well, what does it seem to you?" And she said, "Well, I Daddy's the boss." So what does that make me?" I asked her. And she said, "Well, Mommy, I think you're the owner." So man's the boss, woman's the owner. Daddy's the boss, mommy's the owner. And I thought, for a three-year-old, that's not a bad philosophy for politics and economy. And it's a good context setter, I think, for the conversation we're going to have this evening, and a good way to start off the events at Raritan Valley Community College for Women's History Month. Before I get to the meat of the message tonight, I want to thank Anita Rosenblein and Siham Alfred. Siham, there you are, for inviting me, and the Women and Gender Studies Committee, of course, for asking me to speak tonight, because you really made me think. You get a topic, Egypt and women. How do I put that together? So what is the connection, really? I had to think between a revolution in Egypt or Tunisia or Libya or Yemen or Bahrain and women. What differences do revolutions actually make for women? Where and whenever have revolutions been good for women? And what roles have and do women play in revolution? Well, to me, the first and most obvious answer is that revolution is bad for women. It's dangerous, it's violent. People they love get killed. Food is in short supply, schools are closed. Frustrated men take out their frustrations on women. Indeed, if Super Bowl Sunday is one of the most dangerous days in America for women who have abusive husbands, imagine what it's like in the case of civil war or revolution. And after the war is over, in places like Afghanistan and Iraq, we've seen that restrictions on women's liberty, because we're worried about your safety, right? So women have been asked, and sometimes required, to stay inside temporarily for their own good. Unfortunately, sometimes these temporary measures are institutionalized. So the conclusion I've come to, and what I intend to share with you tonight, is that although we see a great outcry for democratization across North Africa and in the Persian Gulf, although human beings in general are making great strides in exploring self-governance and equality, although people are toppling dictators and freeing prisoners of conscience, and even though we, as human beings, continue to define and redefine the rights of humankind, we have not feminized the revolution. Not yet. All right, what does to feminize mean? Forgive me, I worked in the world of journalism so much, I came up with the word feminize because it rhymed with televise. And I got it from Gil Scott-Heron's 1970 funky rap song, The Revolution Will Not Be Televised. So, revolution will not be feminized. But what do I mean by feminized? I mean to protect women from abuse and harm, to pay attention to women's input in all sectors of society, to include women in decision-making and leadership, to allow women to be powerful and feminine at the same time, and to respect and appreciate the power and empathy of the feminine, and to prioritize women's rights, rights to property, to divorce, to control of our bodies, to keep and raise our children, to vote. Now, do any of you remember the lyrics to Gil Scott-Heron's song? He was really, really quite clever, way ahead of his time, pulling people off their couches, 1970, we didn't even have the term couch potato at the time, pulling them out of their material worlds and pushing people onto the street. He says, and it would be nice to have a the revolution will not go better with Coke. The revolution will not fight germs that may cause bad breath. The revolution will put you in the driver's seat. The revolution will not be televised, will not be televised, will not be televised. The revolution will be no rerun, brothers. The revolution will be live. Little did Gil Scott-Heron know that revolutions would be televised and live. Events in Egypt were live and they were televised. They were Twittered, tweeted, YouTubed, Facebooked, cell-phoned, emailed, and even discussed face-to-face in classrooms and at cocktail parties worldwide. Now, that's a little old-fashioned, I suppose, talking face-to-face, but some of us don't need to do that. Now, I'll tell you, I don't think such speed is really good for us. I think that there's a danger in terms of accuracy, and I think that the speed of transmission of information that is not thoroughly vetted can bias public opinion. You know, before all the cats are out of the bag, we already think we know what's happening. Mark Twain, in fact, is quoted as saying, "A lie can travel halfway around the world while the truth is still putting on its shoes." Wasn't he great? Wow. So certainly, reporters put a premium on getting their stories out, even at the peril of insufficient authentication. Fact-checking is sacrificed to the need for speed. Nevertheless, speed seems here to stay. And certainly women are among the speedy Twitters, Facebookers, and live protesters of Egypt and elsewhere, at least wherever the internet and phone, cell phone access has not been cut off by threatened dictators. Indeed, a 26-year-old Egyptian woman named Asma Mahfouz is credited in part with getting people to show up in Tahrir Square on that fateful January 25th by posting a plea on YouTube. Ironically, January 25th is an official national holiday in Egypt, which is why they call the protests for those days. It's Police Day, recognizing the bravery and sacrifice of Egyptian police who were taking a stand against the British in 1952. Mahfouz said on YouTube, "If we still have honor and want to live in dignity on this land, we have to go down on January 25th. We'll go down and demand our rights, send SMSs, post it on the net. You know your own social circle, your building, your family, your friends. Tell them to come with us. Tell them, instead of setting ourselves on fire, let's do something positive. It will make a big difference." Mahfouz understands the potential impact of social media, and we saw it in the crowds in Tahrir Square. Tahrir means liberation in Arabic. In 2009, we also saw that impact of social media in the turnout of Iranians who were protesting election results. But the efforts we saw aren't directed to impact women per se. Mahfouz as an individual made a difference to the Egyptian people, but not to its women. Her cause was political. And still women's causes, ladies and gentlemen, too often are not viewed as political. They're seen as gender issues that are not relevant to society as a whole, except when they become controversial, something like abortion, for example. An example of this kind of marginalizing of women's issues, close to home here, is the publication of an article by Gloria Steinem this past Sunday in the New York Times. Her piece was called Tough Cookies, and it was about powerful women in politics like Nancy Pelosi and Barbara Boxer. But it was in the Style magazine. And I have to wonder about that. Who are the editors making decisions like an article about these powerful political women should be in the Style magazine? It didn't talk about what they wore. We all know Nancy Pelosi always dresses nicely, but it wasn't about that. Now, Egypt and other Muslim-majority countries are not strangers to women's movements. I'd like to give credit to Cleopatra, if I could, the last great queen of Egypt. And if you haven't yet read Stacy Schiff's extraordinary biography, Cleopatra, A Life, I recommend you treat yourself to it. But scholars, contemporary scholars, will say that the feminist movement in Egypt began in 1923 when activist Hoda al-Sharawi took off her face veil in public, and then she founded the Egyptian Feminist Union. Wouldn't she be pleased to know that her 21st century fans have made her a Facebook page, and you can look for it. A few decades later, in Egypt, came Nawal Sadawi, a feminist, a psychologist, and a writer. I interviewed her for 60 Minutes in 1985. Nawal Sadawi is a secularist thinker. She's Muslim by birth, but she's secular in her thinking. And what we did with 60 Minutes was juxtapose her secular thinking with a woman named Safinaz Kazem, a devout Muslim and feminist who majored in English literature at NYU. Now, Sadawi referred to the African who was such an inspiration to the Algerian independence movement in the 1950s and 60s, Frantz Fanon, in her declarations for women's rights. Safinaz Kazem, who always appeared in a headscarf in public, used Shakespeare in her metaphors for supporting women's self-determination. Both of them made convincing arguments why religion should or should not be used in liberating women from the yoke of male domination. So active conversations going on decades ago about feminism and self-determination for women in Egypt. But what 60 Minutes wanted to see was the secular thinker denounce the religious thinker and to have the religious thinker denounce the secular thinker. To their credit, they respected one another. And to the discredit of 60 Minutes, it canceled the story. Now, these two and countless other women I've interviewed in Malaysia, and Iran, Turkey, Senegal, I love traveling, it's the best part of the job, have all been part of feminizing social priorities for decades. And I'll go into some of that detail later, but we have to recognize they work outside the revolution. Revolution is not about women. It's about governance. Historically and typically, that's men's territory. And although we see women involved increasingly around the world, revolutions do not focus on opportunities for women in the quest for social transformation. And just name a whole bunch of revolutions off the top of our heads or off the top of my list. Iran, Algeria, France. The United States, we had a revolution, wasn't about women's rights or didn't include them. Nicaragua, Libya, South Africa, Russia. I'm hoping I'm making a point. So what do we hope for with regard to our sisters on the Nile, on the Euphrates, in the Atlas Mountains of Algeria and Morocco, Tunisia, and in the mountains and valleys of Afghanistan, and on the streets of Madison, Wisconsin, and Columbus, Ohio. Let's look back for a moment. What were women hoping for in 1776, or maybe even in 1787, when the US Constitution was signed? What were French women looking for in 1789, when their revolution began with men and women together storming the Bastille. What were women daring to hope for in Algeria, where they worked side by side with men, setting booby-trapped baskets in French-owned cafes while they protested 125 years of French domination? What about the crowds of chador-clad women in the streets of Tehran in 1979, day after day demanding the departure of the Shah? Now we watch and wonder about the women of Egypt, Tunisia, Libya, Bahrain. Tomorrow it'll be another country in the headlines. And let's not leave our own country off the list. What women want and expect will change over time, won't it? What women want reflects different cultures and different geographies. But I think there are absolutes across all lines of time and custom, religion, and social upheaval. As different as we may be, there are elements of human nature that are universal. So I suggest that women want safety and security for our children, food on the table, education for themselves and their families. Women don't want to be verbally abused, beaten, or raped, and they want to be protected from those threats. More modern demands from women, I would suggest, are the demand for reproductive rights, gender equality, equal pay for equal work. And those, I assert, are more modern than the demand for personal safety, divorce, and property ownership. In fact, at many international women's gatherings over the last couple of decades, representatives from so-called underdeveloped countries come face-to-face, they come into conflict with those of us from Western Europe and the United States because we don't agree on what are the critical issues facing women right now. It's a luxury. You know, we have a luxury to be able to talk about equal pay for equal work. We don't ask for much, but we know it don't come easy. And it won't come in a revolution. I'm going to take a superficial look at a few examples, and I invite you to challenge me if you don't like my examples. But I am a journalist, so I'm allowed to be superficial. At least in television. Looking back at our own American Revolution, where were the concerns for women? Now, my daughter, the one who said, "Mommy, you're the owner," is now in advanced placement U.S. history at Columbia High School in Maplewood. And in her study, she says, rights for women were at best an afterthought for the framers of our Constitution. So I'm going to read an excerpt from one of the letters of Abigail Adams to John Adams, her husband. And, you know, John Adams, twice vice president, he was president, he was delegate to the First and Second Continental Congresses. He was a diplomat. You'd have to be a very strong and bright woman to be married to a man like that, right? To keep him interested all those 54 years of their marriage. So in March 1776, she wrote to John, "In the new code of laws, which I suppose it will be necessary for you to make, I desire you would remember the ladies and be more generous and favorable to them than your ancestors. Remember, all men would be tyrants if they could. If particular care and attention is not paid to the ladies, we are determined to foment a rebellion and will not hold ourselves bound by any laws in which we have no voice or representation." Well, he wrote back the next month saying, "We have been told that our struggle has loosened the bonds of government everywhere." In other words, encouraged unrest in those colonies and in the new developing United States. Children and apprentices were disobedient. Schools and colleges were grown turbulent. Indians slighted their guardians, and Negroes grew insolent to their masters. But your letter was the first intimation that another tribe, more numerous and powerful than all the rest, were grown discontented. That's us. "Depend on it," this framer of the Constitution writes, "we know better than to repeal our masculine systems. doing so, he fears, would completely subject us to the despotism of the petticoat. Now, he might have been joking around, but let's face it. Rights for women did not come immediately. It was in the one case of voting rights, 132 years later. And I see at the end of March here at Raritan Valley Community College, you have an event looking specifically at the 19th Amendment. And I hope you'll come out and learn something about that there at that time. So 1920, women get the right to vote. And in 1923, something called the Equal Rights Amendment was proposed. That has still not been passed. All right, late 18th century France. 10-year reign of terror and revolution. And 150 years later, women got the right to vote in France. I'm just using the right to vote as an example of when there's a revolution and when there's result for women in that specific regard. By the 20th century, however, there developed an expectation that women would vote, critical mass, and that would come either after independence or by royal edict. So Algerian women got the right to vote the same year independence came, 1962. In Iran, it was by decree of the Shah in 1963. After the revolution in 1979, voting rights continued for women, but for a time, their role was restricted in public life. Today, I can say women are visible in virtually all aspects of daily life in Iran, from government to educators to beggars. And I'm glad to say the last time I was in Iran in 2007, there were remarkably few beggars. Egyptian women got the right to vote even earlier, in 1956, when Egypt's constitution was drafted, and it said, quote, "Citizens are equal in front of the law. They're equal in their rights and duties. There is no discrimination because of sex, origin, language, or religion. But we all know there can be a disparity between law and its application." And I'd like to talk about that just for a couple of minutes before I conclude. I think I've tried to lay out a baseline for similarities in sisterhood struggles worldwide. And now I'd like to focus for a few minutes specifically on women in Arab and Muslim cultures and the disparity between law and its application. In 2004, I had the honor of interviewing Shireen Ebadi, who was the winner of the Nobel Prize for Peace in 2003. She's an Iranian judge and human rights lawyer. She's an equal opportunity critic when it comes to nations with bad human rights records. And high on those lists of bad human rights records, Muslim-led nations, Iran, Afghanistan, Saudi Arabia. But she doesn't fault Islam for this. She told me, "I'm a deeply committed Muslim, and that's why I insist on showing to the world that Islam is not a fanatic religion." Now, in some Islamic countries, she went on to say, they claim that because we're Muslim, we cannot observe human rights. This is not true. Islam has no contradiction with human rights. Islam believes in equality. We can be Muslims and also believe in the equality of men and women. Well, you know, if that's the case, then why do images of oppressed women in Muslim-majority countries seem ever-present in popular media? It's not because women aren't being oppressed. There is oppression of women. So, and for example, why does a poll from Egypt, the Egyptian Center for Women's Rights, reveal that 83% of women there encountered some form of sexual harassment? 83%. With two-thirds of the men who were polled admitting that they had perpetrated sexual harassment. Now, I'm glad to say that harassment was not the norm in Jordan, where I lived last year on my Fulbright with my 16-year-old, the one who's 17, the one who said we're the owners. And I was never harassed in Saudi Arabia when I was reporting there, where I directed films, although the question of covering your hair or not covering your hair came up a lot. I wasn't harassed in Iran, Turkey, or Malaysia, which are all Muslim majority but not Arabic speaking, and it may be because I was an American and a professional. I wasn't a local woman. But I was also harassed in Rome. You know, Shireen Ebadi attributes unequal treatment of women in traditional societies to their patriarchal cultures, not to her religion. Even though there is patriarchy still in Western societies, I mean, I got paid less at National Geographic TV because at the time they paid women less than men, my production supervisor told me, even though I was running the project, people working for me were making more. So there is patriarchy in Western societies, but it is probably more prevalent in Muslim-majority societies, and probably in some Latin societies too, Spain, Italy, South America, Mexico. Possibly. I'm generalizing. But we know that under the Taliban in Afghanistan, women were largely confined to their homes. Girls were prohibited from going to school. And yet in the Quran, the holy book of Islam, there is a repeated emphasis on education for both boys and girls, for men and women. In the days of Muhammad, the prophet of Islam, in fact, in the 7th century, women were active, even conspicuous, in the public sphere. The culture that grew in the city of Medina around the Prophet was far more egalitarian than most other societies at the time. For example, women were not the property of men. They were guaranteed an inheritance and the right to divorce. They were business people, judges, and warriors. Contrast that with the knowledge that as recently as the 19th century, when a British woman married, everything she owned, inherited, and had earned till that time automatically belonged to her husband. Shocking, isn't it? How recently we looked as bad and as backward as we think they are now. Last night I attended the awards dinner for the National Council for Research on Women, and they reminded us then that here, only 15 to 17% of the leadership positions in government and corporate America are held by women. Yet in the Muslim-majority nations of Pakistan, Bangladesh, and Indonesia, women have already been heads of state. There are inconsistencies, and everyone has a long way to go. I'm glad I'm on this side of the ocean in the struggle, but I recognize we have a long way to go here as well. Now, even though speed may be a blight on the truth, as I mentioned earlier, it may be a fertilizer for feminization. People become quickly aware of issues beyond governance, economy, and unrest. And expectations for other kinds of equality within a society are kindled. We're hearing more and more about social mores that are no longer considered acceptable. For example, those statistics about sexual harassment in Egypt. Activists say that attacks on women have been tolerated for years due to an existing cultural norm. Little was done to punish perpetrators. And victims have been shy to step forward because of social stigmas. That has been the case here historically as well. But slowly and surely, as women become more visible in person and in cyberspace, we're taken more seriously, and the boys will be boys attitude is less tolerated. Women were visible during Egypt's February struggle to end the Mubarak dictatorship. They marched along with men. Even a few slept overnight in Tahrir Square. And happily, reports of harassment during those days were rare. Sadly, an attack on a CBS News reporter, Laura Logan, shattered that happiness. Still, I would like you to rest assured that feminism, which is a part of the epic and infinite struggle for social transformation, feminism is alive and well in Muslim-majority societies. I'll give you a few examples before I conclude. In Malaysia, for more than two decades, Sisters in Islam has been working diligently, upholding what it calls, quote, the revolutionary spirit of Islam, a religion which uplifted the status of women when it was revealed 1,400 years ago. Sisters in Islam is led by the dynamic and passionate Zaina Anwar. And its mission statement, which is listed in a reading resource list that I provided to the college, concurs with Shireen Abadi. Their mission statement says, "We believe that Islam does not endorse the oppression of women and denial of their basic rights of equality and human dignity. We're deeply saddened that the religion has been used to justify cultural practices and values that regard women as inferior and subordinate to men. And we believe that this has been made possible, listen, because men have had exclusive control over the interpretation of the text of the Quran." And that's changing. That's changing. It's safe to say that the Egyptian revolution will not be feminized, and neither will be the revolutions that may take place in Bahrain, Algeria, Libya, Saudi Arabia, Nigeria, or myriad other hotbeds of discontent abroad and at home. But today, at the centenary celebration of International Women's Day, we can certainly point to progress in the larger struggle for recognition and equality. It's the kind of progress that survives turmoil, strikes, and revolutions. The kind of progress, slow and steady, on which the future is built. Opportunities for women are not only available, but expected nowadays. Women's efforts are organized, institutionalized, and networked, even in Arabic-speaking and Muslim-majority countries. The internet and social media allow for free flow of information, which also allows for coaching and takeaways for women in countries where they are struggling harder than we are for independence and self-determination. Although the revolution may not be feminized, deeper social transformation is underway. Indeed, I believe it's safe to say that the feminization of the future of nations and the governments to come in Egypt and elsewhere is guaranteed. Thank you.
Thank you so much for that rich and evocative and provocative talk, Anissa. And I love the way you, and I'm sure the rest, everyone else has too. I particularly love the way you put it in the historical context and made some interesting parallels and brought it home really for us in a lot of ways. Now we're going to have some questions from our respondents. We're going to start off with Brandon. I'm a little nervous.
No worries. Thank you again for that. So you just sparked so many questions in my head, and I wanted to talk a little bit maybe about the overall philosophy. Right? You mentioned CBS, that a whole interview that never ran, and the discussion between the theist and the more secular perspectives. Mm-hmm. But do you see any kind of, and I know, you know, we can't speak about women or North Africans or Middle Eastern people as a monolithic group. I mean, there's diversity of opinions and beliefs. So that being said, do you see any kind of guiding philosophy, ideology when I think about civil rights struggles for rights, whether it's, you know, American civil rights, American suffrage, or, you know, gay rights, any kind of civil rights, there's usually some kind of ideology. You know, Martin Luther King is, you're reading Gandhi, and Malcolm X is reading utilitarianism and John Stuart Mill. Is there a guiding philosophy? Is it more of a theistic, a kind of radical, or a reanimation of a rereading of the theism of the Quran? Or do you see it as a more secular kind of movement, or the dialogue in between? What might you put?
Great question. I would say that the nonviolent philosophies are beginning to take root in those regions. I don't know if any of you had a chance to see the film Budrus that came out that talked about nonviolent, in a small Palestinian village, nonviolent protest against the wall that's being built by the Israelis. So that's part of it, but we're not seeing nonviolence in North Africa, and we're not seeing nonviolence in the Persian Gulf. But I do believe that there is a deeper reading of religion now, and that the sort of nonchalance, you know, when you're born into a religion, you sort of, some people take it very matter-of-factly, nonchalance. People may show up at church, not because of the rituals, but because their friends are there, for example. And the same goes for mosques. You know, you go where your community is. But I think people are taking this more seriously now because there's been this horrific violence attributed to Islam. And Muslims have to push back, against the perception that this is a religion of violence, and that demands a closer reading of religion. But there has to also be a balance between mosque and state. You know, the secular part is also growing in discussion. And we notice when we read reports and look at these movements across North Africa and in the Persian Gulf and the Arabian Sea, that people aren't screaming Islam. They're talking about nationalism. And so there have been these waves, you know, there was a nationalist wave and pan-Arabism back in the days of Nasser, and then you know, that didn't work. They were still subject to the influences of foreign economic interests and so on. So, you know, folks are trying different things. So there may not be one single philosophy, but I do believe that there's a closer reading of the religious part and a look at how to balance that with the secular needs.
And I just want to pick, that's exactly what I was asking, so thank you for that. And just into that more, the rereading of the Quran, you know, when I think about the Latin American countries and their civil rights struggles and revolutions,
right.
You know, we hear about things like liberation theology. Right. So is there any kind of movement, or is there something touched on that we could put our fingers on, a name, a movement of this rereading?
Let's name it.
Yeah.
Let's name it. People have been dabbling with the term reformation with regard to what's happening in Islam today. And you know, the Reformation, the Protestant Reformation, was really bloody. Mm-hmm. It was awful. I would not like to see that. So let's go with liberation theology.
Okay. Thank you so much. Fantastic.
Maybe I'll write about that.
Okay. Andrea?
I'd also like to say thank you very much. I actually got to thinking while you were talking about this idea of power, who has it and who wants it. When I think of revolution in historical context and in all the contexts in which you had described, I think about it almost as a feminization of a whole group of people. So in other words, to me, if I were to look at it through a gender frame, I would see the people of Egypt as being feminized by this very oppressive patriarchal government, and that they banded together. And I would actually say that I'm going to challenge this idea of feminized revolution, because I don't feel that there's any other type of revolution other than one that is based on wanting power and therefore being in the position that women currently are in right now. My question for you is actually, I'm sorry, I teach English, so it's going to be three questions.
Yeah, I like that.
It's going to be a series of related questions, but I want to know what exactly a feminized revolution is, because I'm still a little fuzzy on what that might mean.
Well, you just described it.
Did I?
Because
I
think so. I think she did, because she said, here we have the authority, the power, which in the case of some of these governments is oppressive, dominating, and abusive.
Masculine. Yeah.
Sorry.
Easy.
and then the oppressee finally saying, I'm getting out of this marriage.
Yeah.
Which takes a lot of courage. Mm-hmm. So I think you've just described that.
Okay, but then my question for you then is, how do we continue to have revolutions that I feel do liberate feminized groups or peoples? And how might, let's say, social media maybe facilitate this? Like you mentioned Facebook and Twitter and all these new Web 2.0 technologies. Facebook, Twitter, all those.
Okay. I do have a Facebook page, thanks to my daughters. It's good and bad. It's a two-sided coin, because people hear things really quickly and they say, oh, I want some of that. And they spread news, I think, or information or their thoughts or opinions very, very quickly. And kind of catches on. We saw how these ideas ignited unrest going east and west from Tunisia, actually, where it started. So people are seeing a pie and tasting a pie that maybe they hadn't gotten a chance to taste before or only heard about watching television. But television is a few steps removed from these web-based technologies. So they're going to ask for things more quickly, right? The trouble is they don't know what they're asking for. And there's no precedent for democratic systems in most of these countries. Well, there is precedent, but it goes back so far that nobody remembers what it is. Because for how many hundreds of years, the Ottoman Empire, you know, and prior to that, the Byzantine Empire, ruled differently in these areas. And now we're moving into a new phase of governance. And it takes a while to figure out what that is.
Actually, something you just said really triggered something. So in essence, the masses, those that might be discontented, the feminized, are actually growing and their numbers are getting bigger. And because of social media, we're actually maybe going to see a revolution sooner than perhaps we thought, or maybe even something a little bigger than what has been done before.
And there may actually be results, because if people take it to the next step and study what are some of the possible solutions, how do we institutionalize what we're asking for, which is also available more quickly, there may be resolution sooner.
Thank you so much. It really was a pleasure to listen to.
Good questions. And thank you. I guess I'm going to sort of pick up on Andrea left off talking a little bit about social media. And as a journalist, which you are, I think you probably would agree that there's a difference between social media getting information out there and journalists getting information out into the public sphere. So I'm also going to ask sort of a two-part question, but I'm wondering what role journalists can play in promoting feminism or some of these issues of women's rights. And I'm also wondering what role, if any, you think the audience has, not just this audience, but we humans who take part in social media, but who read journalism, listen to the radio, read the newspaper, watch TV. Do we have a role? Do journalists have a role in promoting feminist issues or women's rights? And do we have a role? And what role would that be, those of us who consume the news?
These are really good questions. I applaud your fabulous. Yes, let's applaud the fact. Gives me time to think. Let me refer, just remember Gloria Steinem's, the placement of Gloria Steinem's article. In terms of the way journalism might play a role is to affirm, uplift, and give more credibility to the stories about women that are not just chick stories, you know, that really do reflect society. I know there have been problems. I mentioned Laura Logan. It's tough when you're a reporter going, doesn't matter, male or female, going into a violent situation. It's hard. You are putting yourself at risk. My background is Iraqi. People say, oh, well, why aren't you covering the war in Iraq? I'm a mother. I've got daughters. I want to be alive for them, and I want to be here for them. And when that war's over, maybe I'll go back. So as a woman journalist, it is perhaps more dangerous to put myself into, or to put herself into, the middle of Tahrir Square when people are complaining or when they're celebrating, you know? But women don't want to be relegated to side stories and small stories. Women reporters want to be part of what's going on, what's happening. So it's a tough situation. If our editors, our managers, our assignment editors would recognize the importance of stories that only women can cover, because there are parts of our world that men can't go into. And if those stories weren't just considered lesser but as important as a story about what's happening in Tahrir Square, what's not happening in Tahrir Square, what's happening in the rooms, in the houses, in the coffee shops where women have gotten together to discuss this turbulence in their nation. So I think there could be a transformation in the way we prioritize news. That may be a longer revolution, in fact, than the other ones we're talking about. But that's one thought I had. In terms of the role that the audience may play, there have been audience movements started mostly by Hollywood stars who are protesting the treatment of women in Afghanistan, or there was a case of a woman in Nigeria who was sentenced to death by stoning for an adultery conviction. And you may remember that there was a movement that took off and lots of people started to sign it, but it was because celebrities stepped up first. And with the help of celebrities, I think that we small folks, you know, can add our voices. The case of Nigeria, just as a side story, I want to tell you that the conviction was based on erroneous evidence. In Islamic law, and they said they were following Islamic law, the evidence for adultery is eyewitnesses of the act, four eyewitnesses to the act, adults who are willing to testify. And what they used in this one case in Nigeria was a baby, which is not evidence. It's a result. You can kind of count back what might have happened, but it's not valid evidence in Islamic law. And that became part of at least one of the films that I did. But I'd be interested to hear what our audience thinks, in fact, about the role, the activist role, that we as audience might play. I think that's a very important question.
Okay, this leaves a perfect opening for a segue into the audience, and I know I gave you your thought question ahead of time, and I'm sure some of you may have questions. So let's now go to the audience.